This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Min Rose Nguyen spent her childhood navigating the racially segregated communities of Tupelo, Mississippi. Min Rose was often on the black side of town, under the watchful eye of her grandparents' housekeeper, Eva. At night, she'd listen as her grandparents and their white friends and neighbors told stories and argued politics. Decades later, Min Rose found herself navigating the line between fiction and memory. For her critically acclaimed debut novel, The Queen of Palmyra, she dreamed up a town a lot like Tupelo, and she created a protagonist, a young white girl who develops an intimate connection with her family's African-American maid while the politics and violence of the civil rights era churn around her. These days, Min Rose Nguyen makes her home in North Carolina. She's the Keenan Eminent Professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she's my guest this hour on the program. Min Rose Nguyen, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you very much, Isaac. I'm happy to be here.
So glad to have you here. I want to start with your novel, The Queen of Palmyra, which came out last year. The protagonist, Florence Forrest, is 11 during the summer of 1963 when the novel takes place and is clearly modeled on your childhood. And the first line of the novel, narrated by Florence, is, "I need you to understand how ordinary it all was." Is that something you feel as well?
Yes, I think that's in some ways you can read that first line as ironic, because as we look back now, that was a very extraordinary time. All sorts of historical things were happening, and the civil rights movement, for example, was starting in full force in Mississippi, in particular in that central part of Mississippi where my fictional town takes place, Millwood. Mm-hmm. And the novel is set in the summer of 1963, which was a very volatile time in central Mississippi, especially around the state capital of Jackson. There were boycotts. There were sit-ins at Woolworths. Medgar Evers, the NAACP field secretary, was shot in the back and killed in June of that year. So it was an extremely volatile period. But usually people don't really know that they're living through a historical period. And particularly, I think, for the white population of Mississippi and probably, I would say, all of the South, many of the Jim Crow laws and ways of thinking about things, which were very, very extraordinary if you think about the strangeness of racism, seemed quite ordinary and every day.
Well, what do you recall about how race was addressed in, say, your grandparents' home where you spent much of your childhood? What were conversations about African-Americans, the black side of town, civil rights? What were those like on the porch there at your grandparents' house?
That's such an interesting question because I don't really recall my grandparents talking about race that much. My grandparents were both professional people. My grandfather was a lawyer. My grandmother was a school teacher. And the conversations were generally more about politics, the state of the Presbyterian Church, and so forth. But there were discussions of the trouble, and that's kind of what it was called, racial conflict, the trouble. My grandparents, though, never used racist language, mm-hmm. or what they might consider to be racist language. They used they never did that, and were quite actually proud of the fact that they paid their housekeeper Eva Lee Miller a reasonable wage in terms of the time. And paid her Social Security, which was not then done.
And you've said that Tupelo at that time was perhaps progressive as Mississippi towns went. Is that accurate?
As Mississippi towns went, yes. The reasons for that are complicated, but Tupelo is in the northeastern part of the state of Mississippi. It's not in the southern or central part of the state. There were not large plantation farms there traditionally. It's more a part of Appalachia. We also had a very progressive for the state, which would not seem progressive to us at all today, newspaper editor, and his name was George McLean, and he was the father of my best friend as I was growing up in Tupelo. He had crosses burned on his lawn. He was really castigated by many people in and around Tupelo, but he fought very, very hard for a kind of what we would consider today conservative, but what was then progressive way of thinking about race.
And folks in the town, perhaps including him, worked to keep the Klan from marching in the town as well, right?
Yes, they did. And I remember distinctly one Saturday that the Klan was supposed to march in Tupelo, and all the merchants closed, all of the white merchants, I should say, closed all of the downtown stores that day. They did not want to serve the Klan. They did not want to even be any part of it. And everyone was urged by the newspaper editor and other people in town to stay away from downtown. And so there was also a committee, a group, an interracial committee in town that was headed up by the co-headed, I believe, by the newspaper editor George McLean, and one of the African American pastors in town who tried to negotiate race relations. But nonetheless, it was completely segregated. Segregated town. Mm-hmm. I went to segregated schools, the swimming pools, the facilities, everything was segregated.
I want now for you to read a passage from The Queen of Palmyra so that listeners can get a feel for the book. And this is from the first chapter, and it concerns Florence's father's box. And I'm wondering if just before you read that, if you could just set up for us, what is this box? What does it mean to Florence?
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the story.
Sure, sure. But at the opening of this book, there's this mysterious box.
Sure. After that line, I need you to understand how ordinary it all was. The next few sentences are, at night the phone would ring after supper. My father would say a few quiet words into the receiver. And then he would turn to Florence with a strange pleasure in his eyes, and tell her to go down to the basement to fetch him this box. Meanwhile, in the kitchen, Florence's mother, who was very progressive in her ways, who is the town's cake lady, is clattering around in the sink and angry about the father, Winforest, going out again on to a meeting with his box. So that's kind of the lead in to this segment. Mm-hmm. This much I can see without even looking in her direction. Mama in her apron, still standing at the sink and looking out the kitchen window into the dusky light. Her arms turned in over the sweetheart rose clumps on her apron, as if she's about to gather them up from the front and make a pretty bouquet out of them and put on the kitchen table. But she's not thinking roses. She's thinking about Daddy's box. "Get that thing out of my sight," she said to me one time. I'd brought it up from the basement and left it on the table in the kitchen because Daddy was in the bathroom washing up. The table was little. When we ate, I'd have to sit at its corner so we'd have room enough for our plates. When Mama saw that box squatting dark and solid on her eating table like a big sassy roach, her mouth worked to one side and then the other, the way it did when she tasted a bad egg in one of her batters. She reached down and gave the box a hard little shove so that it slid toward the edge of the table. Just as she did it, and the box was sliding, and I was opening my mouth to say, "Watch out," Daddy rounded the corner of the kitchen. You could tell he couldn't believe his eyes, his precious box. Whap went one hand on its top, stopping it in the middle of its skid. The other hand flew out at Mama, hawk to rabbit. He took her bony little wrist and held it between his thumb and first finger. How he wanted to snap it. He steadied the box, then put his first hand under Mama's chin and clubbed her face up to his. "You better watch yourself. You better watch out." Each word chipped from a block of ice. That's all he said, but his hands did their work on her. The first squeeze tighter on the little wrist. The second pushed Mama's head back and up so high she couldn't move it. Her hazel yellow eyes flared down at me. She wanted me to go away, but I didn't. I watched. Then she squinched her eyes tight shut and just stood there, still as stone. Neither one of them said a word after that. They just stood there locked together. Mama's neck pared back like a radish, so thinly white that you could almost see through it. Then, after a while, he let her go and gathered his box into his arms like his own true child. She sagged, but stayed standing, her fingertips glued to the table's edge to steady herself while he turned and slammed out the screen door.
My guest today is Minrose Gwynn, and she is reading from her novel, The Queen of Palmyra. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk more about that novel, as well as about Minrose's memoir of her relationship with her mother, Wishing for Snow. This is The State of Things with Minrose Gwynn, author of The Queen of Palmyra, and you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour with writer and professor Minrose Gwynn. And just before the break, we heard Minrose read a passage from her novel, The Queen of Palmyra. And I just want to pick up on that for a moment. Minrose, one of the reasons I wanted you to read that passage is it's this moment of real sort of brutality in Florence, the protagonist's house, when her father grabs her mother and doesn't hit her, but grabs her wrist very hard and pulls her head up so far that you describe her neck as pared back like a radish, which is this such an evocative description, almost a beautiful description of this really brutal thing. And I wanted to ask if that's something that you are consciously going for when you're writing these things. It's this beautiful imagery, but this brutality, which seems to really tie into the themes of the novel, even.
Oh, that's a great question, Isaac. The great writer Toni Morrison talks a lot about beauty and language, holding a story that is very, very ugly, and how people. Readers need to be led into stories that are really horrific stories. Of course, Morrison writes about the history of slavery, for one thing. I took my inspiration from some of the things that she said. I've taught Toni Morrison many times, and some of the things she says about writing are very moving to me. And I think we all need this kind of balance in a work of literature between the beauty of the language and the reality, the gritty reality of whatever story it is the author chooses to write. And so that's what I was going for.
I'm struck in the Queen of Palmyra by the way in which, as we heard in that passage, the tension and the violence that exists outside Florence's home, the racial tension and even the violence of the civil rights movement that's sort of churning around her, outside her consciousness, for the most part, because she's 11 in the book, really seems to seep into her home and everyone's home. That sort of that tension and violence makes its way into, it seems, the crevices of people's everyday lives. Is that something that you experienced as a child growing up in that time, or that looking back you see happening?
I didn't experience that. Fortunately, I mm-hmm. did not live Florence's childhood.
Because
it's not good.
No.
but one of my observations when I was growing up, and also now, is that when people are abusive, when people are violent, when people are so troubled by something that makes them strike out at other people. It takes place in myriad forms, not just on the outside of in the street, mm-hmm. but it's also in the home. And if you look at cases in which people are extraordinarily violent, usually it happens in both places. Windforest is, for example, is not just swept away by the violence of his times, but he is right at the front, on the front row of participating in it. He is the Nighthawk for the local KKK chapter. The Nighthawk is the toughest guy in the chapter. He wears a black robe rather than a white robe.
And this is the father of the protagonist, Florence, in the book.
Yeah. Yes, and he is her father. He was actually, although Florence's family is poor, basically. Windforest was based on a neighbor who was the father of one of my very good friends as I was growing up. Except he was rather well off. This person was, and he eventually was put into Parchment Penitentiary. And he fell from one of the leading businessmen in Tupelo, Mississippi, to being in Parchment Penitentiary. It was about one of the worst places you can go. You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well. You, of course, turned to fiction in Queen of Palmyra, which came out, as we said, last year. But you worked for a time as a journalist for newspapers around
yes.
the South, covering some of the events of the end of the Civil Rights era. Tell us about that.
Yes. I worked in Mobile, Alabama. And then I went with United Press International at their Southeastern Division headquarters in Atlanta. And the toward the end of the civil rights period and into the Vietnam protest period, I was there in Atlanta, and I covered several of the poor people's marches on Washington, mm-hmm. and the planning for that was done in the historical Ebenezer Church in Atlanta, and I would go to those planning meetings, and usually I would be the only white individual in the whole church during those sessions, and the church would be packed, and it's a large church, so that was a very interesting part of my time.
But you know, eventually, obviously, you turned to academia and fiction. When did you first start thinking about writing fiction or going into academia, as opposed to, I suppose, staying in journalism?
Well, I had in undergraduate school, I went to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And during that time I was in undergraduate school there, I did write some stories and got some really good encouragement from my professors there in the workshops that I took. Then I went on, I had a minor in journalism, and I went on to do the journalism work. Then I came back to graduate school and took some creative writing workshops and wrote some stories. But during that time, I'd had a child, and I had a family, and I felt that I needed to be able to do something in academics. I wanted to teach, and I thought I would need a PhD in literature in order to be assured of getting a job. And so that's what I did. And so then I got into scholarly writing, and then I started realizing that my scholarly writing was becoming more and more personal narrative. That's when I started working on the memoir, Wishing for Snow.
Well, let's talk about that. The memoir Wishing for Snow was released in 2004, and it's an exploration of your relationship with your mother, Erin Taylor, who was mentally ill. And maybe you could describe. I mean, it seems that from the memoir that she was perhaps always a little bit mentally ill, or certainly different, but certainly descended into that later in life. But what are some of your earliest memories of your mother?
Some of my earliest memories of my mother are of her being quite upset. And this is understandable because my father had left us, as I say in the book, high and dry. Mm. And here she was, a very young woman with a child, and she had to move back in with her mother and father in her hometown. Her life at one point had seemed to be opening up, and then it had been foreclosed. She had no money, no income. She had some child support for me, but she had to go and try to find a job in her hometown because she couldn't. She didn't feel she could make it on her own with a child. So some of my earliest memories, to tell you the truth, are of her being angry with me and her being angry, and that's kind of a sad thing, but it's true.
Well, and what kind of illness did your mother suffer from? I mean, was she mentally stable enough earlier on to be a good mother to you?
My mother was always difficult. Mm. And anyone who knew her knew that. She was extremely eccentric. She would do all sorts of things. She was constantly embarrassing me by all the stuff she does. And I realize that a part of that is children are always embarrassed by their parents. But she did some pretty wild things. She would go to a funeral and service, and then she would just kind of march up and take some of the flowers for herself. She always sang really, really loud at church. Mm. she was a wild woman in a lot of ways. But looking back on it, I realized that she was really a victim of her time. I think that if she had been of my generation, her life would have opened up in all sorts of ways that were wonderful for her. But she was very much a victim of her time, a victim of being brought up in a very traditional way in the South. And I think she would have turned out much better had she been able to pursue her life's passions openly. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, she did begin to pursue those passions, at least later in life, when she decided that she wanted to be a poet.
She did, and she marched herself over to the University of Mississippi, and she started taking poetry workshops, and she decided she needed a mentor. I'll never forget the phone call when she called me. She would call me late at night. She was a night owl, and she would call me, "Minrose, I need a mentor to help me. How do I go about getting one?" And she took matters into her own hands.
And what age was she at this point when she?
She was in her, I would say, mid to late 50s when she started realizing that she had this talent for poetry.
And were you involved in her? Were you reading her poems as she was writing them at this time, or did most of the poetry that you read of hers come? Did you read that after she was gone?
I read some of it along, and it was interesting because when she first told me she was going to be a poet and she needed a mentor and she was going to pursue this, I thought, oh, yeah, mm-hmm, because she'd never been a writer, and I didn't know. So finally she sent me some of her poems, and I looked at them, and I was in graduate school at the time and working on my dissertation, and I looked at them, and I thought, these are really good. And so I started encouraging her, and I eventually published a collection, self-published a collection of her poetry right before the memoir came out. It came out.
Well, I'd really like to hear an example of your mother's poetry. And one poem that is one of the many poems that's printed in the memoir, Wishing for Snow, is a poem of your mother's called Crawl Space, if you would read that.
Yes, and this is by Aaron Clayton Pittner, called Crawl Space. Bury your light beneath a bushel of corn pone and white turnip to warm the cockles of his heart, lest you find yourself alone at table. Sleep small in the hidey hole you fashioned for your own, unless you've outgrown it. And when you've stretched every nerve and fiber of your being, trim the poem without flinching. Fling the gauntlet, pay the piper, dance while you may, dwell in hell or a pumpkin shell for time enough and space to be.
What does that poem do for you? I mean, does that poem, I mean, there are many ways to approach that, obviously, as a reader of poetry, as a daughter, as a teacher. But what is your, what's your reaction to that poem?
If I were teaching this poem, mm-hmm. I would say, I would point out the lines, sleep small in the hidey hole you fashioned for your own, unless you've outgrown it. And I think what happened to my mother was that she did sleep small in the hidey hole for many, many years. And it was a hole that she had fashioned for herself because she was afraid to jump out of her shell. But then in her mid-50s, I think, she outgrew it for one reason or another. I'm not really sure why, but she did. And her life started to blossom. Unfortunately, though, that's when she got cancer and started going down from cancer. And also, it's when she became mentally ill. Actually, those were in the opposite order. I said they were. She became mentally ill, and then she got cancer. And the cancer exacerbated her mental state.
How did your relationship, and you describe in the memoir, I mean, how did your relationship with your mother evolve? Because, as you said, I mean, many of your memories of your childhood are of your mother being angry and upset. And then your memories of her late in life during her mental illness, when in fact you had to commit her a couple of times, were of her being enraged and upset with you for doing that to her. Was there a period in the middle when she was writing poetry and when you were reading it that you developed a different relationship with your mother? Was there ever a period of a relationship of writers, for instance?
I think so. I hope so. Part of my impetus for writing the memoir was to try to know my mother, to try to understand her. We had a very vexed relationship from pretty much beginning to end. And that period was kind of, as you say, it was kind of an oasis in our relationship. But the impetus for really writing Wishing for Snow was the fact that I felt deeply grief-stricken over her death and also very, very guilty because I was young at the time that she became mentally ill, and I couldn't quite figure out how to deal with it. I tried very hard to deal with it in the best way that I knew how, and I guess I did what most people would do during that time, but I think anyone who's had a severely mentally ill person in his or her family will understand that it's so, so hard. And this was back in the 80s, and particularly with the lack of drugs and lack of knowledge about mental illness and the extreme stigma you can imagine in a small town when you have a mentally ill person running around in her nightgown or other things that my mother did, that it becomes a matter of great shame as well.
And so, you describe her, I mean, she was in, you describe her actually closing herself in the closet and scribbling. And at one point, she actually rewrote a scholarly book of yours, recopied it down.
Yes, she copied it down word for word, a scholarly book that I had written. I didn't realize this until later. A friend of mine and a friend of hers, a mutual friend of ours, once said to me, Minrose, your mother wanted to be you. Hmm. And I think that's true. I think, you know, she did want to be me. And I think if she had been a generation later, she would have developed her own life in a way that would have satisfied her and would have given her strength to carry on. But I don't know. There's a lot about genes in this memoir as well. And I have my family is very Gothic Southern family in the sense that they were committing suicide. They were mentally ill. They were depressed and so forth. So she had a lot to contend with in terms of what she had inherited.
And did that ever, having that history in your family, does that make you concerned? does that make you examine yourself? Because you're thinking, I have all of this history. Am I? Do you ever have those moments where you're thinking, uh-oh?
I think that's why I write. I write because I think when emotions and feelings, all sorts of feelings become repressed, that's when you really get into trouble. And so working through a lot of this kind of thing in writing through either characters or my own experience or my mother's experience and so forth allows me to process them in ways that I think are healthy and creative. And that I wish my mother had her lifespan had been extended and she would have been able to see her way to that. As it was, though, she published quite extensively in literary journals.
Well, we're going to talk more about that creative process and writing when we come back. My guest this hour is writer Minrose Gwynn, author of The Queen of Palmyra and Wishing for Snow. Our conversation continues on the state of things. I'm Isaac Davy Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Isaac Davy Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour with writer Minrose Gwynn. She's the author of Wishing for Snow and The Queen of Palmyra, and she teaches contemporary fiction at UNC Chapel Hill. Minrose, I wanted to ask you about your writing process, which we sort of began to touch on in the last segment. And did the novel The Queen of Palmyra and the memoir Wishing for Snow come together in drastically different ways?
Oh, yes. Definitely. But the memoir, putting together the memoir, taught me so much as a writer how to move toward form and structure. It was a very incremental process with the memoir. The first version of it was just a grief-stricken, guilt-ridden version. I put it in the bottom drawer for a year or two. Mm. Then I started looking through my mother's poetry with an eye toward editing a volume of it. And this other thing that I had written came out, and they started merging together the poetry and from my mother's voice and my voice. And then finally, I got a huge box of things from Tupelo when my stepfather died, and I found the diary, that diary of hers when she was 9 years old and wishing for snow during that winter. And so that process was very incremental and very much about, it was almost like a cut and paste sort of process. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot from that about structure and metaphor, how you need to hang a book on metaphor in any kind of way. Wishing for Snow was, I wished for my mother, the mother I never had. She wished for snow as a little girl. She wished for a different kind of life, and so forth. With The Queen of Palmyra, I'd started with the idea that back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, there were a large number of crimes, the racial crimes that were committed in the South that there were witnesses to. But these witnesses would not witness during that period. And there was a particular case that wasn't in the South, but it was in Martinsville, Indiana, of a young girl who had witnessed her father murder an African-American woman. Her father was a member of the KKK, and of course white. And she had witnessed this brutal murder of this young woman. And then she was 7 years old at the time. It was 30 years later in 2004, I believe it was, or three, something like that, early 2000s, that she came forward and said, I remember this now. Hmm. And her father was old, of course. And there have been other cases of this kind of belated witnessing. So it got me to thinking about seeing and not seeing, how crimes, terrible things, can be committed in cultures, and people can be observers to those, witness to them, but yet they can somehow manage to block those out of their consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so that really was the key factor for me.
And, I mean, one question is, given that there is, of course, all this historical material and your own personal experience of it, why a novel and why not memoir or history?
Well, I had written scholarly books. I had written a memoir, and I thought, I need to be challenged again.
So I
wrote a novel. Also, I think with a novel, of course, you have a great deal more freedom because you don't have to adhere to the factuality. Mm-hmm. And some people today say that you don't have to adhere to factuality when writing a memoir, but I'm one of the kind of old school people who think that the truth is important. And so I think with writing a novel, there's the challenge of getting to a deeper truth of human emotions. In a sense, this novel, The Queen of Palmyra, is really just about some of the most basic of human emotions: love, hate, fear. It's fear that prevents Florence from witnessing and testifying to what she has seen. And this in turn wrecks her entire adult life. It's the adult Florence's voice that we hear telling this story, although the child Florence's voice comes forward very strongly within that older voice.
Mm. And your scholarly books that you wrote before the memoir and the novel were about many of the themes that run through mm-hmm. Queen of Palmyra. I mean, race and gender in the South and in Southern literature. And I'm curious if having all of that academic and intellectual baggage, if you will, from those books, did that facilitate writing a novel like this, or was it ever stifling in a certain way?
Oh, I think it really facilitated it, because I've studied racism a lot, and racism is so complicated and so difficult to talk about. But I've pondered it a long time, and where does it come from, and what's it about? And Florence's father, Wynn Forrest, is such a horrible, horrible man, and it would be easy to make him into a stick figure of a villain. Mm. And I worked really hard against that impulse to make him all bad, and tried to see where he was vulnerable and what instigates this. And so I think the scholarly books really helped me understand that. But in a more specific way, I was, at the same time I was writing the novel, I'm also working and continuing to work on a scholarly book on Medgar Evers and remembering Medgar Evers, who was, as I said earlier, the NAACP field secretary for the state of Mississippi in the late 50s and early 60s until he was killed and became the first political assassination of the 60s. And so I know so much about that one period of the early 60s in Mississippi from working on the scholarly book about Medgar Evers. For instance, in the first chapter of the novel, there are several newspaper articles cited, not cited, but discussed. Mm-hmm. For example, the story of the brown recluse spider, which is in the 60s, made its way down to Mississippi. And also the story of an alleged rape of a white woman by an African-American man. These two articles are side by side pretty much in the Jackson Clarion Ledger in May of 1963. And they're there if anybody wants to go to the microfilm and look, because I have, because I was working on the Medgar Evers book. So that kind of level of detail really helped me a lot. And, with the novel.
And the next book is called Mourning Medgar Evers, and it looks at memory and how his legacy is kept alive through plays, songs, movies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. One of the things I'm so interested in, and I teach courses in this, and I think both, as we were talking about earlier, both Wishing for Snow and The Queen of Palmyra addresses the question of memory and why we remember certain things and why we forget certain things, both as individuals and as a culture. And so I'm exploring how memory gets transmitted culturally through writings about Medgar Evers. So this isn't a biography of Medgar Evers, although I have a really long introduction that talks about everything that he did and what kind of leader that he was. But I also am very interested in how he gets remembered, not just his death and not just the trials around his death, but the man himself. And so I look at different forms of literature, writings by Eudora Welty, James Baldwin, poet Margaret Walker, to name a few, some memoirists of the period. And then I also look at songs of the 60s. You'd be surprised. There are many, many songs of the 60s that were absolutely about Medgar Evers. But we don't hear him today, do we?
No, we don't. No.
Yeah,
That. And I mean, is there something, one thing perhaps that you could pinpoint, I mean, that in doing this research that's surprising to you about the way in which we remember now Medgar Evers that might have been different or that has changed over time?
Well, I'm constantly surprised about how many people have forgotten who Medgar Evers was. Hmm. And I'm not alone in this. Many of the scholars who have worked on Medgar Evers have commented on it. But most especially his widow, Merle Evers Williams, has commented again and again and again about how she feels her husband's memory has not been given proper due, you know, in history.
Do you mean just remembering the story of him and that he existed, or more about who he was and what his work was?
Well, really just knowing who he was, simply knowing who he was. And she tells some rather heart-wrenching stories about being on college campuses and walking up to students and saying, "Do you know who Medgar Evers was?" And they'll say things like, "Well, was he a baseball player? Was he a great basketball player?"
Wow.
You know, things like that. So I think part of the big impetus for this book was to talk about remembering and how we remember as a culture.
And I mean, what a fascinating point in American history for to be thinking about how that memory is transmitted over the decades. I mean, of course, because in many ways it seems now we are relitigating some of the memories of the segregationist South now. Not long ago, the Haley Barbour, governor of Mississippi, who was flirting with the idea of running for president, gave an interview in which he talked about the white citizens' councils of Mississippi of his youth, and implied, if not said outright, that the citizens' councils were nonviolent, perhaps even facilitated integration. And a lot of people did not agree with that take on it, what I guess would be the diplomatic way to put it. I mean, and so I think there is this question about are there really many ways of remembering that period? Are there ways that we should be remembering it that we should be agreeing on at this point?
Well, that's one of my main impetuses for writing The Queen of Palmyra, is I was trying to look at that very issue. It's funny you say that, because Hotting Carter has used to call the Citizens Council hoods and suits. I think Haley Barbour's just absolutely dead wrong there, and the Citizens Council were motivated by exactly the same thing, the same sort of racism that motivated the Klan. They were just upper class, more upper class versions of that, and also that motivated what was known as the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, which was basically a state-funded, state-run Gestapo in Mississippi at the time. And so all of these institutions together, the Citizens Council, the Klan, and the Sovereignty Commission, made things almost impossible for not quite impossible, of course, as we know historically, but close to impossible for things to change.
I want to get back to the writing process a little bit. I mean, you were teaching creative writing workshops at UNC. I believe you're going to be teaching a nonfiction writing workshop in the coming semester.
That's the first time I've taught a creative writing workshop at UNC.
Well, and you've taken creative writing fiction workshops in your time. And what kinds of advice was helpful to you when you started out? And what do you tell budding writers?
Oh, great question. I think one of the most important things about writing is to develop the discipline of writing. Writing is thinking, and you have to write in order to find your way through a work. And so one of the main things that I try to encourage students to do, and I've taught at creative writing workshops in the summer, and I taught at creative writing workshops on the graduate and undergraduate level at Purdue before I came to UNC, I try to tell students of writing that you have to write in order to write and to apply seat of pants to seat of chair and fingers to computer and write. And every day, Flannery O'Connor, I believe it was, who said, every morning I go to my typewriter and I listen for the voices to tell, and if nothing comes, nothing comes, but I'm always there to receive it in case it does.
And of course these, and I think both these books you said you wrote over many, many summers of writing, and so that discipline was needed, and we're the better for it to have the Queen of Palmyra and Wishing for Snow. Min Rose, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Isaac. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Min Rose Gwynn is the Keenan Eminent Professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also the author of Wishing for Snow and The Queen of Palmyra and co-editor of the Southern Literary Journal. And this Wednesday, the 27th, Min Rose will read from her works and sign copies at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. That event begins at 7:30 p.m. For more information, you can visit minrosegwynn.com. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show or want to hear archived editions of past programs, go to our website at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stasio.